2 Samuel 12, we've got Nathan's parable here to David, and let's just unpack it a bit. Verse 1, there were two men in one city. This is clearly David and Uriah. And David could see into the backyard of Bathsheba's house, which means she was the girl next door. They were next door neighbours. And you remember Uriah came to see David and he got him drunk, but he did not go down to his house, implying his house was sort of at the end of David's backyard. So they were in one city, Jerusalem, the one rich and the other poor. Well, David was rich in that he was rich in relationships. He had all manner of women in his life that it seems God had given him. Whereas Uriah was in that sense poor. He had one beloved wife. Now, David then is likened here to the rich man who abuses the poor man. And yet, David, in his Psalms, particularly Psalm 119, asks God to condemn those who abuse the poor. Now, Psalm 109, well, when was that written? Well, it does seem it was written at the time of his persecution by Saul, and David feels that he's the poor man. And he says this to Saul when Saul wants to have him as his son-in-law. He says, look, I'm a poor man. And yet also Psalm 109 seems to have been rewritten under inspiration, I guess. Well, under inspiration, certainly. To be relevant to the time of his sufferings at the time of Absalom's rebellion, which is sometime after his sin with Bathsheba. So David, I think, doesn't quite maintain this sense of humility. At the time, he's convicted by this parable that, yep, I as the rich abuse the poor, but then he starts going off about, and condemn those rich people who abuse the poor. Well, I suppose you could say that he had repented of that and believed in forgiveness to such an extent that he could actually say that. Or you could argue that, as often happens with us, in the cusp of conviction, on the cusp of conviction of sin, we are very small and man comes down very small before God. But then as the years go by, you get back to your old arrogance. Well, the idea of the story is that the rich man had very many flocks and herds, verse 2. I suppose the argument was that, David, you had no sexual need for Bathsheba. So to take her was just kind of narcissism in its extremist term. Which I think shows that God does take account of human weakness and human basic need, in this case sexual need. And he's told that, look, God gave your master's wives into your bosom, they loved you and you had good relationship with them, and if that was not enough, he would have given you more. Well, quite how to understand that, I'm not sure, but you could argue, look, one man, one woman, that was the basis of the whole deal in the Garden of Eden. And polygamy is therefore, you can say, sinful, because all sorts of men who are going to be in the kingdom were polygamists. But you can certainly say this was not God's intention. The rough balance between male and female of 50-50 would indicate that. God didn't make, you know, 5 or 6 times more women than he did men. That's not how it turns out. So polygamy was not God's intention, and yet, in this parable, God seems to be saying, look, I know your needs. I know how you are wired, David. If you needed any more women, I would have given them to you. But I gave you enough. You know, he had at least 7 sons by 6 women in the first 7 years that he was king in Hebron. You can work that out from the Chronicles genealogies. Plus, it says he had other children by concubines. So he had plenty of women in his life. And God, my point is that God kind of made allowance for that. And you marvel really at how generous God is, really. And how it's not that he bends his own laws, but he does take into account human weakness. And this was all the more so why David was so wrong. Well, David also had come from a family that had only a few sheep, you remember. His brothers say to him when he comes to fight Goliath, with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? Well, he should have known how Uriah felt. And so, really, again, his sin is all the more culpable. And, of course, David knew Uriah. He was one of his mighty men. They'd been in the wilderness together. And it would appear from this parable, if you look at the detail, he had one little ewe lamb which he bought and raised it. And it had grown up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food, drank of his cup, lay in his bosom, and was to him like a daughter. So, admittedly, the relationship between Uriah and Bathsheba was slightly odd, in that he was more of a father to her, and she had grown up with his children, bringing her up really from babyhood, mothering her, fathering her, as it were, letting her sleep in his bosom. It could imply that his own wife had died, and female mortality rates were pretty high in those days, and maybe her parents had been killed. And so Uriah sort of adopted this girl into his family, but then he ends up marrying her. Now, it could be implied from the genealogies in 1 Chronicles 3 verse 5 that she didn't actually have any other children before those she had by David. Possibly she was barren until that point, or possibly it was an unusual relationship and they did not, for whatever reason, have children between each other. Then verse 4, a traveller came to the rich man, David, and he wouldn't take of his own flock and of his own herd to dress for this wayfaring man who'd come to him, but he took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man who'd come to him. This would imply, I suppose, that the frame of mind that sort of hit David was not his usual frame of mind. You wondered about the Lord's parable in Luke 11, verse 6, when a traveller comes, and the idea is that you go to the person who is more wealthy than you to provide for that traveller. But that's another story. You can think about that later. So, although his behaviour was out of character, it is described as a traveller coming to him, it is nonetheless culpable. And you think of how Moses spoke inadvisedly with his lips, the psalm says. And for that, when he struck the rock and spoke wrongly to Israel, he was not allowed to enter into the land. So no matter how uncharacteristic failure may be, it is still sin. Verse 5, David's anger was greatly kindled, and he said to Nathan, "As Yahweh lives, the man who has done this is worthy to die." Well, he's outraged, but actually he's going way beyond the law. The law did not require the death penalty for the theft of an animal. So you see how morality can sort of function in one part of a person's life, but not in others. And this was the challenge of the laws about the burnt offerings, that every part of the animal was to be offered. Whereas he was sort of burning down one side with zeal for justice on one level and yet totally immoral on another sort of part or angle of his life. And so it is. You hear a lot of outcry these days by people who claim to be so incensed by injustice, and rightly so. And yet, is that sort of a common bar which they apply right across their own lives? Well, it seems not. Really. So he says, 6, he shall restore the lamb fourfold, which is exactly repeating the law in Exodus 22, verse 1, stolen lambs shall be restored fourfold. Well, of course, that fourfold judgment was to come upon David. Bathsheba's child died, then Amnon, Absalom, and Adonijah. But I think David was so used to living beyond the letter of the law, you know, he acts as the high priest at times, that he thinks, I give this fellow the death penalty. Well, yeah, but it was that whole attitude that I've seen through the veil. I've seen to the essence of things. I'm beyond the letter of the law. It was this, actually, which in this case, unrestrained, led him to an awful sin. Nathan says to him, verse 7, "You are the man." And Paul is clearly alluding to this in Romans 2, verse 1, where he says, "You are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are that judges, for wherein you judge another, you condemn yourself." Surely Paul has this whole thing in mind, "You are the man." And he's saying that David, then, is every man. David is all of us, and he will repeat that in Romans 4, when he says that we are all actually in David's position, and we have all sinned when we should not have done, and we therefore are going to be judged, and there is no sacrifice to offer. But you can throw yourself on God's grace if you do so with the intensity that David did, and that is the challenge, not assuming and presuming upon God's grace, just because there is such a thing as God's grace. So, verse 8, I gave you your master's house or family, Saul's family, and your master's wives into your bosom. Well, wait a minute, let's work this through. David was married to Saul's daughters, two of them at one stage, and also to Saul's wives. Well, this is really breaking the law of Moses, is it not? But God allowed that. And as I say, he goes on to say, if this all that I've given you had been too little, then I would have given you more. I would have added to you many more such things. As I say, this really shows how God is willing to calculate and factor in people's weakness. You see, God could have just taken the view with David, look, one man, one woman, that's the deal in the Garden of Eden, that's it. No more. But, okay, he saw this guy was whatever, needed to do something with his testosterone or whatever, and so he cuts some slack to him, quite a lot of slack. Now, we cannot presume upon this, and I think that the problem with David is that he did commit the sin of presumption. And that's why, verse 9, why have you despised the word of Yahweh? This is the language of the sin of presumption. In Numbers 15, the soul that does anything presumptuously has despised the word of the Lord, and that soul shall utterly be cut off. In fact, the death penalty for David was specifically, I think, because of this sin of presumption. And you can see how it is with grace and seeing beyond the letter of the law, that if you're not careful, it can lead you into the mess that David got into. Yes, it is all true. You can see beyond the letter of the law, and sure, salvation is by grace and not by law. But you still have to give due attention to God's word and to the letter of God's law. That is the intention behind the letter of that law. And we who live under grace can so easily make the same mistake that David made. Right, so God did make concessions to David, many of them, and he abused them and ended up committing the sin of presumption, for which there was no sacrifice. As he said, you don't desire sacrifice, else would I give it, Psalm 51:16. So, because of this, sure, David was punished. The sword will not depart from your house because you've despised me. David, as I say, came down very small here, and man does come down very small when he's confronted by his sin. But the problem is that over the years, we are all liable to slip back. And I think David did. I think when you look at the Psalms that are written after the time of Bathsheba, particularly those that are written at the time of Absalom's rebellion and the grief he had with his sons, well, David, you know, this is what God said. The sword is not going to depart from your house because you despise me. You committed the sin of presumption, so this is how it's going to be. And yet he rants and raves about those supporting Absalom, and he really rants and raves about them and how unjust it all is. You just notice that as you come to read through the Psalms. And I, as I say, I can only conclude that whilst what he says is true on one level, on a personal level, I think it shows that he had slipped back from this awareness and awesomeness in the face of God's grace. And that is the sober warning for all of us.